list of the sort of main issues you need to consider when you're seeking to either raise debt funding or capital funding out of Australia. But in my experience and practice, it's always a combination of sort of what works in Australia and then what is being driven from the foreign jurisdiction and the needs and requirements of investors in their own jurisdictions and what they're looking for.
You're listening to Australia's podcast for accountants, Tax Talks, the podcast to grow your firm.
Welcome to episode 320 of Tax Talks. This is Heide Robson, and thank you to Class for sponsoring this episode. When your client receives an investment from overseas, be it debt or equity, what are the tax implications of inbound investments? This is the question for Clint Harding of Arnott Block Liebler in Sydney, which he will discuss with you in this episode. The first question to Clint is how to approach this question. Would you split inbound investments into equity and debt? And then whether land is involved or not, where do you start?
On the topic of inbound investment, you're right in that. I mean, there's generally two ways of getting money into Australia from offshore. You either invest it by way of equity or debt. A lot of sensitivity around this in the Australian tax system, because obviously if you invest it by way of equity, generally tax is paid in Australia, and what the non-resident investor takes out of Australia is a return of that after-tax profit in the form of a dividend. If you invest it by way of debt, then what comes out is interest on that debt, and with that is usually associated a deduction. That's very different to returns on equity as a return on debt, because that comes out as interest and that is deductible. So that is a net reduction in the amount of tax collected and paid in Australia. So a lot of our regimes to do with international taxation, and these are mirrored in other jurisdictions, are around that sensitivity around equity and debt in terms of what comes into Australia. And by way of example, you'll see, I can list three or four regimes you've got to start with. You've got the debt equity regime in Division 974 that sets out a set of rules to determine whether or not a particular financial instrument is a debt interest or an equity interest. And in turn, that impacts on whether the return on that instrument is treated for Australian tax purposes as a interest payment or a dividend, and thus frankable. And you'll recall when we spoke a little bit earlier, we talked about the hybrid mismatch arrangements. And that's obviously a classic example of where the way Australia taxes certain instruments can give rise to a mismatch. So then you've got a flow on set of rules after the debt equity rules to then deal with any arbitrage. Likewise, then you have dealing with debt coming into Australia, regimes like transfer pricing, which ostensibly seeks to apply an arm's length price to that debt. And that was the Chevron case. So that was a case where you had the Chevron parent lending into Australia and a big fight over what the appropriate interest rate on that debt should have been, because from an Australian perspective, we want to make sure that interest rate isn't too high, because that obviously lifts up the deduction and then reduces the amount of taxable profit in Australia and therefore the amount of Australian tax paid. So you've got transfer pricing, and then you've also got things like thin cap, which we touched on again, thin capitalization, which we touched on again briefly last time we spoke. And those are rules designed to sort of put a ceiling or a cap on interest deductions by limiting the amount of debt that you can inject into an Australian subsidiary. So there's a whole lot of regimes that are all worthy of their own sessions, but all of those are aimed at sort of dealing with this question of about how you get money into Australia and then what shape those returns on those funds take when you take it out.
I have two questions regarding equity and debt. The first one is, double tax agreements seem to be very straightforward when it comes to debt. It usually is 10%, and the double tax agreements and the amendment protocols usually don't change that. It's just 10%. But equity, there seem to be a lot of variations, how much you hold in the other entity and whether it's franked or not franked. So is it that there is a lot more nervousness around equity than about debt, or is it more that they want to support equity investments and hence there are a lot of special exemptions and special rules?
It's a good question, Heidi. I think the answer is probably it's both. I think there's also a lot of difference in amongst treaty partners and non-treaty countries in terms of how of withholding tax on the way out of Australia for dividends by virtue of the fact that there's a lot of different regimes around the world for treating dividends, participation exemptions, tax and credit methods. Australia is one of the few jurisdictions with an imputation system. So that's very foreign to a lot of countries. And so because of the different way different countries deal with dividends and the taxation of those, I think that gives rise to a bit more variation in terms of then what you see in the treaties and how they seek to deal with it. So I think that's one reason why you've got a bit more variance in terms of withholding tax. The other thing I should note too is withholding tax on interests, that you've always got to look at the domestic rate first and then apply the treaty. It's important to keep that in mind first. So we have a domestic rate, and then what the treaty does is potentially cap that in certain circumstances. So we talked a bit about last week, it's important that when you look to a treaty for trying to work out what the correct withholding tax rate is, you make sure that both parties are actually covered by the treaty. So that involves checking whether they are actually residents of the other jurisdiction for the purposes of applying that treaty, that they're not acting out of some permanent establishment in another country or in Australia. And that's particularly relevant to financial institutions like banks that traditionally have had branches in other jurisdictions, which will be a PE. And secondly, checking things like in the US treaty, that limitations of benefits article, to make sure again that the party that you're seeking to pay the interest to is actually a party has the benefit and the protection of the US tax treaty. So there's a few steps you need to take before you get to that. And then with interest, you're right that it's generally 10%. That's certainly our domestic rate. But there are other exemptions. There's exemptions in our domestic law, like Section 128F public offer exemptions. So that's for publicly offered debt securities and syndicated loan facility agreements above certain amounts. Then you don't even need to go to the treaty because you've got an exemption at domestic level. And so what you'll see is you'll see often sizable debt issuances. So for a syndicated facility agreement, it has to be, I think, more than, Alex, can you remember? I think it's 100 million, but take that on notice. But so very large debt raisings, or loan notes is the other way to do it. And there's no specified minimum for that. But generally, you're talking tens of millions before you can publicly offer it. So there are exemptions from withholding tax domestically. The other good one to remember under treaties is that under Australia's more modern treaties, so treaties sort of entered into after around 2007, 2008, there'll be an exemption for interest paid to financial institutions and other similar businesses and the taxpayers in those jurisdictions that are in the business of lending money. So always particularly relevant if you're borrowing from a foreign bank in one of those jurisdictions. So I think the main treaties that have got that are Japan, Germany, UK's got it. I think New Zealand's got it now. The US has a financial institutions exemption for interest withholding tax. But a lot of the older treaties don't. So it'll vary by treaty.
But if you now look at small business, so a small business is looking for a small business investor to come in from overseas. And if you now first look at debt, then the withholding tax is 10% on interest, but after that, the debt is basically done and dusted. Unless your interest is over 2 million, then you have to worry about the thin cap rules. And of course, if your interest is not at arm's length, then you have to worry about the transfer pricing rules in general. But usually debt coming from overseas into a small business in Australia is very straightforward. You just have 10% withholding tax, and that usually is it, correct?
That's right. And no withholding tax on the repayment of principal. If you've got guarantees from Australian entities too, so if you've got a parent company that might guarantee the loan of a subsidiary, then you've got to apply sort of a different lens to if that guarantee is called on and there's a guarantee payment made by the Australian guarantor to the offshore lender, then generally you would be required to bifurcate that guarantee payment, even though it's not technically principal or interest, it's a guarantee payment. Generally, you would split that and apportion some of that to interest.
So if you have a guarantee, then it gets more complicated again. But if there's no guarantee, then it's very straightforward with respect to debt coming into Australia.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Now, you mentioned the Chevron case. Is the Chevron case so important because now we have more clear guidelines what interest rates are accepted and what interest rates aren't accepted? Why is this case so significant?
Depends on who you talk to as to whether it is significant or not. The ATO was successful in that, but I mean, these things are always so factually specific that sometimes it's hard to pull points of principle out of them. Chevron descended into a battle of experts largely, and there's all sorts of issues around it. There was a lot of the discussion was around the parent company guarantee, like what is an arm's length price for, do you take into account the specific elements of that debt and the situation of the borrower when you look to find out what an arm's length interest rate is. So there was some guidance around how you do that, whether or not when you're looking at comparables, you take into account things like the security that's been provided or parent group guarantees. But largely it was a big fight between experts as to what that arm's length price would be. But I guess what it does stand for is it does, you do need to have some regard to, especially where there's related parties involved, having some sort of support. And the ATO has got some really good guidance for smaller matters and Chevron about what sort of evidence and principles you can apply when you're pricing debt between related parties. So there are some good resources, and the ATO has tried to be as pragmatic and realistic about that, because there is no, unlike thin cap, there is no de minimis with transfer pricing. So it could potentially apply if you had a $10 loan coming from an offshore party. So you do need to pay regard to it. But I mean, I wouldn't go and read the 100-page Chevron decision and hope that you can come away from it with some sort of pithy, simple summary of the Australian transfer pricing landscape. And don't forget, our rules have all changed recently as well. So we've got a different set of provisions in 815 now that enable the commissioners to sort of approach transfer pricing disputes in different ways.
So Chevron was about transfer pricing and not about thin cap.
Correct. It was about what was the applicable arm's length interest rate to be applied to a loan into Australia.
So that was inbound debt. So now looking at inbound equity, then of course it's all about how the dividends that are leaving Australia are treated on the way out. And when I say dividends, of course it could also, the inbound equity could also go into a trust. Have you ever seen that inbound equity goes into a trust? I can imagine it mainly always goes to a company, correct?
No, not at all. It's very frequent for inbound equity to go into a trust. But when I say trust, it's a unit trust. So if you're looking to raise investment from outside of Australia, obviously a discretionary trust is not going to be used because the beneficiaries in that don't have any interest and the underlying assets of the trust other than a right to be considered by the trustee when it comes to distributions of income and capital. So, but certainly unit trusts are very common in terms of investment into Australia, certainly at the larger end of town. Most of you might have heard of the phrase managed investment trusts or attribution managed investment trusts. There are certain category of unit trusts that effectively form the backbone of Australia's REIT industry or real estate investment trust industry. And obviously they were deliberately designed to offer incentives to non-resident investors to invest in Australia, particularly in Australian real estate and passive assets. So if you've got real estate, that's generally a pretty good way to go, because under those regimes, distributions or distributions out of that managed investment trust have a flat withholding tax rate of 15%. I think it's down to 10 now for if you've got an asset that's a clean, green, 5-star energy rating building. I think you can get down to a 10% withholding, but the default sort of is 15. And that was as low as, I think, 7.5 when the rules were first introduced. And then they wound those back a bit to take it back to 15, but still not a bad. And from an external investor's perspective, it's still better than paying corporate tax in Australia at 30%, especially where they're investing from a low tax jurisdiction or somewhere where there might be some tax leakage somewhere in the structure. So, I mean, my discussions with clients always cover both trusts and companies, and there's certain benefits towards both. But the way you take effective equity in the shape of a trust is you subscribe for units in a trust. With a company, you obviously subscribe for shares in a company. And with a company, you receive dividends. With a trust, you don't receive dividends. You receive trust distributions. Those obviously attract different tax outcomes from an Australian perspective.
So putting managed investment trusts and large debt raisings aside, when you just look at equity coming into Australia to a small business, would you then still also see equity going into a trust at the small end of town?
All right, it would depend on the circumstances. You can always top hat a trust with a company later on. So often you will see startups, especially sort of more in the venture capital space, may often start life as trusts and be top hatted, but I mean, I think it's probably a lot easier for one of the problems we have with trusts in Australia is that they're not well understood in a lot of foreign jurisdictions. Like, for example, the US doesn't really understand trusts. A lot of Asia doesn't really understand trusts. They don't understand what it is. And when you tell them it's not a legal entity, it's just a fiduciary relationship that really becomes a difficult conversation pretty quickly. So they're not that user-friendly outside, and you'll see the government re-announce that they've been working on it since 2017, CCIV regime. So again, this is the beginning to town, but they're trying to sort of introduce some form of collective, CCIV stands for Collective Corporate Investment Vehicle. So something modelled on like some of the vehicles you find in the UK and the US that is corporate in form, but allows sort of a flow through taxation. So we're trying to get to there in Australia, and this consultation again happening on that regime. But that's all partly designed to address that the common form of investment vehicle for funds, if you're setting up a fund in Australia, is a trust, and it's not well understood by foreign investors. So I think the same would apply at the small end of the market. It's a lot easier if you're trying to raise an equity investor investment to potentially structure yourself as a company. But depending on the tax implications and the size of the investment coming from outside, your investor may not be happy with sort of paying tax at 30% in Australia, where they may not get a credit for that. So, for example, if we talked about it the other way around, but if an Australian invests in a US company and that US company pays US corporate tax, the Australian investor doesn't necessarily get a credit for that. And so the question is whether you can find some sort of better tax outcome taking into account all of those things. So we should, I guess, be clear about how distributions made from an Australian trust to, and this is complicated because you're right into Division 6 and of the 36 Act that deals with some of these. But essentially, if I had to summarize it, if an Australian trust, other than a managed investment trust or an attribution managed investment trust, makes a distribution to a non-resident under Division 6, what happens is the trustee gets taxed on those profits or that share of income, and pays that to the tax office. And then the non-resident beneficiary is required to lodge a return in Australia, and it will get a credit for the tax paid by the Australian trustee. So that's another reason why a non-resident investor may not want to use a trust, is because absent being a MIT or an AMIT, default position is it must lodge an Australian return on any income it receives out of that trust.
When the trustee pays tax on the trust income that is distributed to the non-resident investor, is that taxed at marginal tax rates or top marginal tax rates?
There's a special set of non-resident rates, but it will depend on the identity of that beneficiary. So individuals, I think, have the flat. So without Medicare, so I think, what's that, 45%, I think, would be the rate. And then for companies, I think it might be a flat 30. I'm not sure they distinguish between small and SME, and the 25% rate and the default rate of 30. I'd have to take that on notice.
When you say individual or companies, do you mean the trustee or do you mean the beneficiary?
The beneficiary.
Okay. So if the beneficiary is an individual, then the tax rate most likely is 45%?
Yes.
For the trustee. And if the beneficiary is a foreign company, then it possibly is 25% if it's an active small business, or 30%.
Yeah, I'm not sure whether those small business rates apply in that context, but one of those two.
You know, it doesn't sound like a great deal. When you invest into a company, you pay 25% and then you get the 75% without withholding tax, whereas now you have to pay 45% tax. The trustee pays 45% tax if the beneficiary is an individual. Then you have to lodge a tax return. Then you get the 45% tax as a credit. Is that refundable?
If you end up paying more, if the trustee is withheld and paid more than what your liability is at the end of the day, then you should get a refund of that.
Okay, good. So that means in the end, trust distributions are taxed at the non-resident individual tax rate.
If the beneficiary is an individual, yes.
Yes, yes, yes. If the beneficiary is an individual. If it's not an individual, then it probably is 30%.
But don't forget, if you're lodging a return, then that brings into, because withholding tax is done on a gross basis, right? So it's calculated by reference to the payment that's going out. Whereas if you lodge a return, then you can claim against that income any deductions that you might be able to claim against it, and then calculate your tax liability on a net basis. So there's quite a few nuances in here. And obviously the tax credit. So if I'm a foreign company and I invest into an Australian company, let's say that Australian company earns $100, it pays 30 cents in the dollar Australian tax, pays out 70 as a fully franked dividend, no further Australian withholding tax. And let's just say I'm in a jurisdiction that doesn't have a participation exemption. So let's just say I get taxed on that 70 in my own jurisdiction at 30% again, and I don't get a credit for the Australian tax. Is that better than investing through a trust where the trustee deducts 30, but then I lodge a return, claim my deductions, pay Australian tax myself in that return of X, and then can claim a credit against the equivalent amount in my own jurisdiction?
And the deductions would be things I incur, like phone calls or trips to Australia or whatever I incur to manage.
Whatever that non-resident may have. I mean, it's got to be done under our rules. You're lodging an Australian tax return as a non-resident. But for example, if you've borrowed money to make that investment, you might be entitled to an interest deduction.
Okay, so let's say it's $100 of income. The trustee paid $45 in tax. When I'm now the non-resident, I do a tax return. I have $100 of income. Let's say I had $20 of expenses for interest, trips to Australia, etc. So that leaves me $80 of income. And then now, of course, the question is, what are the non-resident tax rates?
Yeah, well, I mean, you can assume the top rate would be 45%. So on a net amount.
Okay, good. So that means my income of $80 is taxed at 45%. And that then leaves Australia and then no longer subject to withholding tax, correct? Because we have a trust distribution. It's not subject to withholding.
Yeah, the trustee has paid tax. Often people refer to that as a withholding tax, but it's actually a tax liability on the trustee for which the beneficiary receives a credit.
Leave Australia without a withholding tax. And then, of course, the question is how it is taxed overseas. To me, it sounds like a lot of trouble for not necessarily much tax gain, but I guess it depends. It depends on the individual circumstances here.
Yeah. The extent that it's useful, it's the 45% rate for non-residents comes at anything over 180.
Yeah, grand. Okay. Thanks, Alex.
So that means the trust is really only of interest to the non-resident when he has major deductions to claim against the income.
Yeah, and obviously if it's non-taxable Australian real property being held in the entity and it's a unit trust, then you can avail yourself of the CGT exemptions for non-residents in Division 855. And for those who are familiar with it, the Greensill decision is pretty much, I think, it's still potentially subject to appeal.
Yeah, I think it's at the High Court at the moment, isn't it?
Yeah, you cannot, the correct view is that you cannot apply Division 855 to non-resident beneficiaries of a discretionary trust. It has to be a fixed trust for the purposes of Section 855-40.
Let's leave Greensill aside until the High Court has come to a decision, because I think at the moment it's not even clear whether the High Court will allow the appeal, correct?
No, I don't think special leave's been heard, but I haven't kept up with that necessarily, but I don't think the special leave application's been heard.
So for equity to come into Australia, there are two options. You can either invest into a company or you can invest into a trust. Investing into a company is relatively straightforward. If you receive a franked dividend, there's no further withholding tax. But of course, it means you don't receive a foreign tax credit for the corporate income tax that was paid in Australia. Whereas when you invest into a trust, you have this palaver that the trustee has to pay tax, and then you have to lodge a tax return. But of course, there is the possibility that you can claim deductions and also that you receive a foreign tax credit for the tax you paid in Australia.
Very good. Palaver is an excellent word. So I like it. The only thing I would point out with that is that there are some countries that may allow a credit for tax paid by an Australian company. Some countries have what they call deemed tax paid rules, which will effectively allow you to get the benefit, that recognise the fact that really a company in many respects is just another form of withholding. That's really when you want to tax the profits in the hand of the ultimate shareholder. The tax paid by the company is really just a form of withholding tax in and of itself. And so some regimes will recognise that and allow a deemed tax paid credit.
And then just one last question. Usually it's a franked dividend and then it's very easy. You don't have withholding tax. If it's an unfranked dividend, then of course you have to go to the relevant DTA and find out what the withholding tax rate is on that, because it's either 30% or 15%, depending on whether the other country has a DTA with Australia or not?
Yes. So as I say, when I put my tax professor hat on, the first place to start is what is the domestic withholding tax rate on a dividend, and that's 30%. So that's your default. And don't forget, you've got a number of countries that don't have treaties with Australia, notably Hong Kong and a few others. So if you're paying an unfranked dividend to an individual or a company in Hong Kong, 30%. And then, as you say, you then look at the treaty and make sure that the entity you're paying to it isn't operating through a permanent establishment in another jurisdiction, that they're a resident of that jurisdiction for treaty purposes. And then you look to the article that deals with dividends, and it may serve to cap that rate generally, as you say, at 15. But in other treaties, there'll be differing rates, everywhere from 10. I think the US treaty, you can even get down to zero if it's listed companies involved and things like that.
Actually, I have two quick questions for you. There's often a mentioning of, you know, payments to a PE, a permanent establishment in Australia, are not subject to withholding tax. But you can usually just assume that if you pay to an Australian bank account, that no withholding tax applies, that there is a PE, whereas when you transfer to an overseas bank account, then you need to ask more questions. But usually if you transfer within Australia, you can be sure that you don't have to do withholding tax, correct?
Well, that's a really interesting question. A bank account itself generally won't be sufficient to create a PE. So that's actually a really good question, as to what extent does the payer of that interest or the dividend need to go to satisfy itself that where it's paying to is either a resident or a non-resident. Generally a residence, and the bank account details. I'm not sure just a bank account would be sufficient. You might have to figure out the address. I haven't looked at that. That's an interesting point. I've got a bank account in three different countries. I'm not quite sure that if they paid me interest into those accounts, that it would be free of withholding tax.
Okay, so you might also have to look for an ABN, for example.
An ABN would probably get you off the hook, but I mean, you're looking at the rules around what is a permanent establishment. Generally, it requires some sort of physical and temporal presence in the country. So I'd have to go back and have a look at the withholding tax rules and what they say about what is, when as a payer you can be satisfied that it's not going to a non-resident.
And then my last question is basically just looking at funny games you could play with this. In theory, you could have a foreign investor sitting in a country that doesn't have income tax, and then you pay a franked dividend to somebody in that jurisdiction. And then it's unclear what happens to the money or whether it finds its way back to you. Just in theory, there would be, I don't know, I'm not sure where I'm going with this question, actually. But yes, in theory, you could set up something that you have Uncle Sam. I don't know which countries don't have an income tax. I think Bahrain or UAE or so.
Caymans, Bermuda, BVIs, lots.
Exactly. If you were from those corners of the world, in theory, you could have a relative there as an investor. You pay dividends to those relatives, and then it's basically just taxed at 25%.
Yeah, and it's tax avoidance, so you can't do that.
Yes.
So, okay. I mean, Part 4A extends to schemes and arrangements designed to avoid the payment of withholding tax. So you've got to think about Part 4A. You've got treaty shopping. Some articles actually have treaty shopping arrangements. So treaty shopping refers to the practice of scanning databases to find a country that has preferential treaty withholding rates and utilising those. You've now got, we talked a bit about them last time, we've got the hybrid mismatch arrangements, so they can apply to imported foreign hybrid mismatches. So that places some, you can have a look at the ATO's latest draft ruling on that, that sort of places some requirements on Australian taxpayers to look up the chain where you've got sort of tax havens interposed as blockers and ownership structures. So there's all sorts of things. If you think that it's too good to be true, generally it is. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of other stuff. Obviously, Australia has capital gains tax withholding as a form of another withholding tax. So those were measures brought in about 5-6 years ago now, designed to deal with non-residents selling assets directly in Australia and then the money leaving Australia before. And yes, they've technically got a requirement to lodge an Australian tax return, but obviously the reason we have withholding tax as a concept is that it's very difficult for governments to firstly enforce and then collect tax from foreign jurisdictions. There are various jurisdictions and we have mutual enforcement treaties and procedures with. But generally, that's pretty difficult. So that's why you have withholding tax to try and get the money before it leaves Australia. And so Australia responds to that by imposing a set of capital gains tax withholding requirements. And so that will, you need to be aware of that. If you're selling everything from property to shares and the vendors, you either generally need some sort of clearance certificate or declaration by the vendor that they're resident or that they don't have to withhold. So it's another type of withholding tax.
Yes, Clint, I'm actually very glad that you touch on capital gains tax. When our investor invests into a company and then a few years later sells his shares in that company, is that subject to Australian capital gains tax?
So that's where you apply Division 855, which I talked a bit about before. Division 855 basically says that non-residents are exempt from, or capital gains tax will be disregarded to the extent that what they're selling is not taxable Australian property. And taxable Australian property is broadly direct interests in Australian real property or indirect interests in Australian real property. And I think there's branch assets and a few other things limited. But generally speaking, if a non-resident is selling a piece of land, they will be subject to Australian capital gains tax. If they're selling shares in a company where they hold a greater than 10% interest, on a non-portfolio interest, and at least half of the assets broadly buy, and I'm speaking at very high level again, there's about 50 cases on arguments people have run through all of this, but broadly, if you're selling shares in a company, you hold more than 10% of those shares and more than half of the assets of that company by value represented property and property interests, real property assets, then they will be subject to CGT, otherwise they won't be.
So that means our investor who, for example, invests into 40% of an Australian company would be able to sell his 40% of shares without any Australian CGT.
If that company is not land rich or...
Exactly. If there's no land in the company.
Yeah, if there's no land in the company, then absolutely.
The property development. How would you structure that with foreign investors? Would you usually use a company and then they become shareholders, or would you go through a trust? Or it's too difficult to say, isn't it?
It is a really hard question. It depends on the nature of what they're doing. Are they passive? Are they active? But broadly, development activities are active activities. So you generally got to be a bit careful depending on how many investors you have, because we've got a set of rules in the 1936 Act called Division 6C, which deal with public trading trusts. So certain types of trusts where they have a number of investors can be taxed as companies, even though they're set up as trusts. And generally that looks at things like the type of business the trust is carrying on, or whether that constitutes what we call eligible investment business. And so there is a possibility that even if you set up a trust and you've got, and that trust is first a public trust and secondly a trading trust, that trust could be taxed as a company anyway. So it really just depends. But I guess the key point with property development is generally what you're then distributing is not capital gains. You'll be distributing ordinary income, because property developers don't make capital gains. That really throws out the whole CGT sort of exemption, and things like that become sort of less relevant.
That's actually a very good point, and actually makes it more simple again from a tax view, because you're basically back into franked or unfranked dividends.
Potentially, or trying to navigate their way through a trust and how that all works. But there's generally a bit of reluctance for non-resident beneficiaries to lodge tax returns in Australia on trust distributions they receive. That's why I've talked a bit about it before, but under the Managed Investment Trust and AMIT regimes, that withholding tax on those payments is a final tax. So there's no requirement to lodge returns then on the non-resident investors.
Is there anything else we should cover?
We've covered about 6 pages out of 3,400 pages of tax legislation. Look, I think that's a pretty good rapid fire hit list of the sort of main issues you need to consider when you're seeking to either raise debt funding or capital funding out of Australia. But in my experience and practice, it's always a combination of sort of what works in Australia and then what is being driven from the foreign jurisdiction and the needs and requirements of the investors in their own jurisdictions and what they're looking for. The good thing with debt and equity is neither of them has GST. So one thing you don't have to worry about is the GST treatment on distributions of dividends or interest or anything like that. So that's a positive. We'll end on a positive.
Well, Welcome back. So when foreign investors sell their Australian shares, they don't pay CGT as long as they hold at least 10% and as long as the company doesn't hold taxable Australian property, so-called TAP. Tomorrow and on Wednesday, we will run two US episodes, US number 10 and 11, with Marsha Dangog of Withers in San Francisco. Tomorrow, we will look at the popular structure of an LLC with a C-Corp blocker, and that will be a very long episode. And then after that, we will look at Australian loans to US entities, and that will be a relatively short episode. Next Monday in episode 321, Simon Calabria of Webb Martin Consulting in Melbourne will talk about structuring across borders using expansion into the US as an example. Until then, thank you for listening and thank you to Class for their support. Bye for now and see you in the next episode.